Hello?
Yeah, it's on. Is it on?
I believe it's on.
Well, if it's on, you're going to find out about it when you try listening to it again. Uh-huh.
Thank you. and of the smaller towns in America, where there might be some Orthodox communities where that some people have blood, some people don't. Point of the matter is that if you come from a community that keeps glad, and the definition, by the way, is not that the rabbi clapped on the shtender and said, from now on we're keeping glad, or made a gezerah. It's even though, historically, the reason why in America, everybody, I mean, not America, the most communities are makpid on glad. What I mean by makpid on glad is, you can't find a Shomer Shabbos kosher butcher that will sell non-glad meat. All Shomer Shabbos butchers only sell glad meat, as in the greater New York area is one example. You won't find an Orthodox butcher selling non-glot meat. You just can't. Okay? That is the definition of the community keeping glot, at least according to Rav Lichtenstein. And the halacha is that if your community keeps glot, you are mechuyav to follow that minhag, or meaning to follow the halacha, and keep glot. Even when you're coming to visit Israel, when there's so many yummy restaurants that are not necessarily glot. It is your community's minhag. I know of people that don't realize this, and they assume that since they were growing up, you know, a person, let's say, who's, I don't know, 60 years old, 50, 60 years old, when he was growing up, you know, there was available non-glat, and he knows his father ate non-glat, so he assumes that his minhag is to also eat non-glat. But things have changed. In other words, already for 40, 50 years in the greater New York area, everybody only eats glot. That's the only thing that's really available. And therefore, your minhag really is to keep glot, and you should keep glot. This is on top of the discussion that we had last week about a mahadrin to uda. In other words, if you have a restaurant that has a mahadrin to uda, not only is it superior as far as supervision, and therefore similar on the level of supervision that you used to from your various communities that you're coming from, as opposed to popping in once a day or once a week. On top of it, it also means that the meat is glot. You can have restaurants, theoretically, that don't really have a mahadrin to uda, but if you ask them, they'll say, yes, all the meat that we serve is glot, bake yosef, or etc., etc. That you would have to, take the word of the waiter or the owner or whatever, that indeed that meat is such. The mashkiach is not telling you that the meat is glat, because only thing mashkiach tells you is what's on the te'udah. So again, if it's a mahajan te'udah, then by definition the meat is glat. If it's not a mahajan te'udah, so the guy might tell you that the meat is glat, and that might or might not be true. On top of it, you don't have the same supervision. Yes?
I just want to make sure, when you say not keep glad, it's not that they don't check, it's just that they're not mocking on all the specific legion.
The community?
When you said the Machloket Rishon, whether they keep glad or not keep glad, does that mean...
I said that was a simplified version. In other words, the Machloket Rishonim is that what some Rishonim hold the animals with this type of legion is not kosher for consumption.
But no one says that you can just not check and it's okay.
Correct. Everybody holds you have to check.
Okay.
Right. Yes?
At one point, does your community change?
Good, very good question. If you make aliyah, so then your community becomes, you lose your, where are you from? Tinek?
Yeah.
Just a blind guess. Right? Your community then is no longer Tinek, but becomes Israel. And once it becomes Israel, then the community of Israel, so to speak, doesn't really have a minhag of keeping glot. And then you would be able to decide on your own whether you want to stop keeping glot or not. And again, just as a point of the Ramah says, it's preferred, even though it's not necessarily the minhag of Ashkenazim. Yeah?
Does a community mean a rabbi of Yeshua, or does it have to mean like a rabbi of Yeshua holds one thing, the rabbi of
Yeshua? No, I'll tell you why. Because it, the people that daven in Yeshua, the rabbi of Yeshua can hold one thing, but it's not as if everybody only buys from this particular butcher. There are some communities, let's say, as an example, the Royers community in Washington Heights, where they only buy from the butcher that has a hashkacha of their community. There are particular communities that have their hashkacha, and they won't buy outside of it. I don't think that's necessarily the case in most other communities. So, you know, I'm saying community is the available meat in the area. Okay? All right. Another term that you might come across is that even among glat, there are different types of glat. What do I mean to say? There could be hashkacha of many different, first of all, many different rabbis. I don't think that you have to spend time differentiating between this hashkacha, that hashkacha of glat. If it's a hashkacha, you know, and it's glat, I think you could be somach on that. But one big, one generalization difference is you have domestic glat and you have imported glat. Domestic meaning the animal is shechted here in Israel. Okay? Could be glat. Imported glat means it was, in most cases, from South America, Uruguay or Argentina. And it could be called, let's say, Argentinian glat. Argentinian glat, in my opinion, is a safer bet in that you have at least the standard of the Rabbanut HaRashit. You know, there's one particular standard. Our yeshiva uses Argentinian glat meat. Meat that came from Argentina, glat. There are people from various Haredi communities that might not eat that meat. In other words, there's some communities that only eat the shtita of Rav Reuben, and you have some communities that only eat the shtita of Eid HaChredis. Like you might in your communities might have come across people that only eat Lubavitch shtita or only eat Satan shtita, that type of thing. So you have that. You should be aware, if one of your friends asks you about the meat, you say in yeshiva, it's glat, it's Argentinian glat. Another term that's thrown around and used for quite often by restaurants to mislead people is the word Beit Yosef. Now, I mean, Beit Yosef. Beit Yosef. Okay? Beit Yosef in Israel could mean two different things. It depends on the context that the way it's used. I'm talking in connection to meat and kashrut. Beit Yosef could mean Rav Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch. And you could say that if he tells you the meat is Beit Yosef, what it means is it's following the rules of Sirchot and Glat that the Beit Yosef set down. There are a small number of differences between the definition of Glat according to the Beit Yosef and the definition of Glat according to Ramah. But again, I don't think, in my personal opinion, I don't think that you have to differentiate between that. So a lot of times you'll see a person or a sign even saying, Chalak Beit Yosef. And what that means in that context just means that the shita that's followed is that of the Beit Yosef. It doesn't mean that Rav Yosef Karo is the Mashkiach. Okay? And it also doesn't mean, and this is the other term of Beit Yosef, which is Rav Avad Yosef. How many of you have heard of Rav Avad Yosef? Okay? Rav Avad Yosef is one of the Gedolei Hador. Okay? Probably the Gedol HaPoskim. Probably one of the greatest halachic minds of our generation, and he is the leader of Shas, okay, which you know some people don't like, that he's in politics, whatever. The fact of the matter is, he has his own hashkacha that's called the hashkachat Beit Yosef. Okay, if you see the word Beit Yosef, you have one differentiation. His hashkacha is a very good hashkacha, and you could be somach on it. You know, the Tudah says on it. You know, let's say Beit Yosef, you have to look at the small fences and look for the words Rav Avad Yosef Shlita. Maran Rav Avad Yosef Shlita. Otherwise, the word Beit Yosef, as I told you, just means, it's a generic term. It just means the type of glat that it is. It doesn't mean hashkacha. So don't be fooled by the words Beit Yosef. Yes, Eitan.
You mentioned before that glat means
Shacharot. Louder, I'm sorry.
You mentioned before that glat means without any shifa, means completely chalak. So what's the difference between Glot, which is completely
halak,
and Beit Yosef glot, which is also completely
halak. Correct. I'm not going to get into the nitty gritty, but let's just say there are slight differences. There are slight differences. In my opinion, I don't think you have to be mechalik. In other words, if it's halak, you could be so much that it's halak. But yes, there are people that differentiate. Yes, Chaim.
When you have this halak Beit Yosef, does that mean that? Was there anybody supervising that it was Chalak Beit Yosef, or just the owner says
that it's... That's it. You know, you could see a sign or print that out on an advertisement that write the words Chalak Beit Yosef, that means nothing. If you see Tachat Hashkachat Beit Yosef, that probably means Rav Avad Yosef. It's just, he's just telling you that this is the type of meat I use, and you have to take his word for it. I mean, I don't think you should. I think you should be somewhat on the hashkacha, not on the owner of the restaurant. Okay? We're good? Yeah.
What about other imports that aren't Argentinian?
Not that many.
Okay, and then also, what about non-Mahadran half-shirts that they're the rabbanus that you said are good last time?
Okay, so last time, I'll repeat what I said last time. Even in Yerushalayim, in my opinion, you people coming from... You, basically, to keep a standard of full-time supervision, you have to use Mahadran Yerushalayim. If you use a regular... Yerushalayim is a good city. It's among the best. But even among the best, a regular Tuda means that the guy is trying to cover 30 or 40 different restaurants and he's popping in once a day. and the owner is chiloni or worse and doesn't care about kashrut in the least. And there's a big hole as far as the supervision.
I know the Gush Etzion or the Efrat ones, which you said are good even if they're not Mahadran.
Yes, I did say that.
So what about the meat? Does that need to be gone?
If it's Mahadran, no, I'm sorry. I don't know if there are such places in Gush Etzion. I don't think that there are. But you are right. Theoretically, if there'd be a meat place in Gush Etzion, you would have to look for the word chalak. Yes?
What makes imported meat better than domestic meat?
Not better. It's just, you know, in other words, you just know that I happen to know the standard of the Rabbanut, and I know that it's fine. But as I said, I don't think you have to be mechalik. If you know for a fact that it's chalak, you see it on a piece of meat in the freezer or whatever, you could be somewhat. It's in a package. If you have a document, you're not being somewhat on some guy that tells you, oh yes, this chunk of meat is chalak, but you see it, let's say, in packaged food, that's fine. And we're talking about packaged food. There's a minhag of some yeshiva boys to make cholent. Okay, about 5 years ago, there was a Maaseh Shehayah. I was on a Shana Bet Shabbaton together with the guys, and one of the guys who made the cholent, some reason we started to talk about the meat, what meat to use, etc., etc., and he pulled the package out of the garbage in the kitchen, and he showed it to me, and my heart sank as I saw that the meat that he used, not only was it not chalak, and he was serving it to everybody, but it was lo mukhshar. Okay, lo mukhshar means that the meat wasn't salted. In other words, it was non-kosher according to all Jews. It wasn't salted. There's a halacha that you have to draw the blood out of meat before consuming it. Okay? And there are a number of ways of doing it. One is salting and one is roasting, whatever. I don't get into how to do it, etc., etc. But I just want to let you know that in Israel, in the freezer section of many, many grocery stores, they sell meat that says on it kasher, and then underneath it, sometimes not such big letters, lo mukhshar, which means not salted, not kosher. It's not koshered meat in English. Okay? Be aware that that also exists, so you have to be careful. Okay, what other questions were there on meat? Yes, Akiva?
Can you explain, like, I know there's like this thing with the nuts.
What?
But nuts, kosher.
Did you get that little handout that I gave last week? So one of the word badatz just means betin tzedek, and anybody could open it. You could open up your own badatz. We can call it badatz gei betin tzedek shel Akiva Fader, and then it would be a badatz. You could declare yourself a badatz theoretically, a betin tzedek. I mean, you probably would need, let's say, two other people to be fair to call it a betin. So what I'm trying to tell you is, yes, there are a couple of different organizations that starts with the name badatz. And most commonly, the word badatz refers to the Eidah Haredit. Okay, Eidah Haredit. You've heard of Eidah Haredit? Eidah Haredit. Okay, those are the anti-Zionistic Haredim, Hasidim specifically, that live in Yerushalayim, and mostly in Meir Shar. Okay? They are ferociously religious. Okay? And everything that they believe in. That's normally, if someone says badatz, that's what they're referring to. But it's not true. In other words, you could call it badatz Beit Yosef, which is a Ravad Yosef. You could have a badatz of bells, which is a Beit Tzedek of the community of bells. You can have many different, and lately, over the past 4 years, there've been all kinds of new badatsim, like badats akiva fader, a badats kesher hakashrut, hold hakashrut, nezer hakashrut, or some of them legally phony baloney. You know, legally the government is suing them because they are misleading people. Yes.
So one more time, how do we tell the difference between Bet Yosef, that is just the owner telling us?
You look for on the Tudan, you look for the name,
yeah.
Rav Avadya Yosef Shlita.
Okay.
Yes, Daniel.
What's the source for
glad in
the
Zvar? The source for glad in his Behemah, which, how did, I need someone who's a Baal Korei. What is it?
Behemah, which trade for a local chal, something, right?
Trefa. The concept of a trefa. Trefa is mentioned in the Torah. One of the ways of becoming a trefa is to have a hole in the lung of an animal. And halachically, it happens enough that you're chayav to check. Yes.
You said
going to someone's house or you're going to a hotel?
No, I was staying in the restaurant.
On Shabbos, you're not going to a restaurant?
Over the weekend.
What's the Shabbos?
You can call me for guidance and I'll give you some guidance. You can call me for guidance and I'll give you some guidance if you want. But not off the top of my head other than the places I mentioned. Okay, we're moving on. Yes, Michael.
If you do pick up meat that was not salted, you just pour on.
No, I'm not going to give a shiur on how to salt now. If it was me, I would give it back to the makolet, or I would throw it in the garbage.
And what on the fact that?
But it could be salted. It would be a neat, you know, experiment.
And the makolet here has glot and not glot.
Yes, the makolet here sells glot and not glot. The community here in Alon Shvut consumes glot and non glot, which brings me to a very important question: what if you're invited to someone's house in Alon Shvut? Do you have to ask them if the meat is glatt? Well, I tell you, 70% of the time, you're not going to be served meat. You're going to be served chicken. Sorry. All right? Or turkey. But let's say you're served meat. Rav Lichtenstein feels that you don't have a chiyuv to interrogate the housewife as to whether the meat was glatt or not. I'm not going to go into explaining why now. If you want to try to explain it later, I don't have the time to explain. You don't have to ask. Okay?
No, it's not.
I would expand on that, not even outside of Olam Shvut. I don't think you have to ask. If you go to someone's house for Shabbos, also as far as the fruits and vegetables, because the vast majority of people buy from the supermarket and not from the shuk, again, you don't have to ask about Hafrosha Truma Namaso, you can assume that it's okay. Okay, if the people start talking about what they picked in the garden or on the tree, then you have to start worrying if these are the type of people that know about the mitzvah field fires and things like that. Okay, let's get to another point. Gelatin. Gelatin is a protein. Okay, amino acid. That has a property that it could be dissolved in a liquid, and when that liquid cools, the molecules create a type of a lattice that traps the water in between this lattice and creates a certain thickness or rigidity or some kind of a yummy dessert sometimes, depending on how it's made. This protein, this amino acid, could be found in animal flesh, bones, etc., but also could be found in vegetable form, from vegetable source. A few years ago, the vast majority of the gelatin on the market only came from animals, and usually it's stronger, it has a more longer lasting effect, it's easier to be used in industry, etc., etc. And there's a machlokes rishonim and a machlokes poskim. If I take the bones of a horse, okay, or if I take whatever, you know, dead cows that weren't shechted, and I extract the gelatin from it in powdered form, and when it's in powdered form, it is not roi l'achilat kelev, meaning a dog would not eat it. So at that point, all Rishonim, all they would agree, that powder is not treif, even if it came from a pig. because it's no longer oil achila kelev. It's no longer food. The machloket rishonim starts when I take this powder and I reconstitute into a delicious dessert. Okay, now it's very yummy. Do I say that the original iser is reawakened chozer v'nior, or do I say not? And that's a machloket rishonim, machloket poskim, and it could have gone either way, but in the United States of America, all poskim fell into line and basically hold that you cannot consume that gelatin that came from animal source. Okay?
What was a kosher animal, let's say a cow shafted properly?
Theoretically, there was short times in history that was done, but it's just not cost effective, and they don't do it. Nowadays, what they do, when vegetable gelatin won't do the trick, like in marshmallows, it usually doesn't do the trick, they use co-gel that's made from fish bones. Okay? In any case, back in way when, I don't know, was it 1948 or whatever, the Rabbanut HaRashid of Yisrael decided that they're going to be somach on this animal gelatin heter, and therefore they allowed using animal gelatin. It went on for many, many years. Huh?
Who is matir?
The Rabbanut HaRashid of Yisrael. They passed in that direction. So that Jews from Chutz La'aretz, almost all communities in Chutz La'aretz, don't eat animal gelatin. Okay? No restaurant, no product that would be given a hashgacha if there was animal gelatin in it. That Jews from Chutz La'aretz wouldn't be allowed to eat it, while Jews here would be allowed to eat it. It's another din in the community. However, in the year 2000, the Rabbanut HaRashid changed its mind. And they decided our policy from now on is that you can't use animal gelatin. Nonetheless, there are some huge companies that somehow, I don't know, got permission for the Rabbanut because of the loss of money, etc., to continue production on certain things, and therefore, theoretically, no, practically, there are still some products, like Elite products, as an example, regular Elite Toffee, I think still has animal gelatin, and the yummy jelly worms and jelly this and jelly, I don't know, bears and gummy bears and all that type of stuff. Quite a bit of it still has animal. Quite a lot of the brands still have animal gelatin. But other than that, it's been phased out simply because of mad cow disease, and that the European Union standards do not allow animal products to be put into these type of things. So that it's being phased out from the market completely. But in the Far East, etc., these candies are still made, and yes, they're still sold in Israel. And therefore, I'm just telling you, be careful of Elite Toffee, regular Elite Toffee. Elite has two brands. There's regular Elite and the Haredi brand that's called Megadim.
Elite.
Huh?
Elite Elite.
And now, just the last flash over the past month, there's some products of Elite that has an OU on it. And that, you know, is okay. Okay? Yeah, so you go to the shop or you go to some candy store and they give you scoops and you see all these gummy bears, etc., etc. Unless the whole store has some kind of a, you know, mahanjan hashkacha, you can't be sure that doesn't come from animal source. If it's packaged, then you could read it. And if you have a chredi hashkacha on the outside of the package, you know it's good. Or if you even have a regular hashkacha and it specifically says gelatin from plant source, like gelatin with a gimel, gelatin with a little thing on top of the gimel, gelatin meaning makor tzimchi or tzimchi meaning vegetable, then you know it's good. Okay, you don't have to worry. Maybe everything I'm eating or buying is gel. You don't have to worry. You don't have to check. The two things I'm telling you have to check are three things: marshmallows, gummy things, like the wormy things, etc., and the Elite Toffee you have to be aware of. Anything else, I wouldn't worry about anymore because it's quite rare. Yes, hello.
So at least in the shop when they sell gummy wormy stuff, they have different sections and you ask them like which stuff you pick one that didn't mash up, which ones are, like sometimes they'll say like it's better.
I wouldn't buy anything that wasn't packaged in a bag so that I could read exactly on the bag what's going on. Yes, Chaim.
Aren't the ones in
In Me'e Shorim, yes. I would say in Me'e Shorim, you know, as I told you, the minhag of burning down stores.
Buddha?
Yeah, I would say that no one's going to be selling gummy bears that have, you know, that have pig feet in them. Yes?
The stores that are generally have large containers of gummy candy stuff open.
Like really large ones? Like the type you want to just like dive in there? I'm saying that it's cheaper to use the quarry stuff for mean animals. It's a cheaper product. And therefore, if it's not packaged, you need a mashkiya, so to speak, to tell you what it is. If it's from a package, then you read the package. And by the way, that includes the kid that's in front of the makola on Fridays. Okay? If it's in a package, then you can read the package and see what the deal is. If it's not, unless the kid tells you, then maybe it could be somewhat on it. It's probably an 8F and that would be sort of, yeah. Because the animal isn't shafted properly. There is no gelatin that's produced today from animals. It's just not. It's not cost effective. Okay? Now we're moving on to the topic that, oh my goodness, that I really wanted to talk about. And that was Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galiyot. So I'm going to try to talk as much as I can. Another new challenge when you come, ask me after Shir. Another new challenge when you come to Israel is this issue about how many days Yom Tov should I be keeping. Now, I'd like to preface this Shir in revealing that it's not very halakha l'maisa, because in my opinion, what I want to do in this Shir is take you from the basic makar, what the story is about and why it's an issue when, and to really understand what you know, 2 days is about, and what 1 day is about, and what 1.5 days is about, to understand the whys, and etc. That's what I'd like to do in this year. How do you come to a decision? I can tell you how you can't come to a decision. You can't come to a decision on your own. You can't paskin halacha on your own yet. Bezer Hashem, a day will come when you'll be on the madrega of for posek, and you can pass things halacha on your own. At this point, you can't. So how do you decide? So the answer is, you go ask your Rav. Your Rav is the person, well, usually it's the rabbi of your shul, or maybe it might even be a rabbi of your high school that you always went to for halachic decisions. Your Rav is the person you always turn to when you have a halachic question. Asei lecha Rav. A person should make himself a Rav. Okay? How does one do that? A lot of you ask yourselves, well, I don't really have a Rav. I never ask a Rabbi my shul anything. I don't want to talk to him because we're angry at him because of the speech he made. Well, okay. Unless for whatever reason you decide you want to make yourself, you want to find a new Rav. What do you look for in a Rav? Where do you get them? Where are they cheapest? Okay. When you're looking for a Rav, first and foremost is a person that's going to tell you God's truth. He's got to be an expert in the area that he's talking about. It is possible to have one Rav in Hilchot Shabbat and a different Rav in Hilchot Kashrut if you're convinced, you know, that one is really knows that inside out, while the other one knows that better inside out. There's nothing wrong with that. It's wrong to shop around for a Rav that's going to give you the makel opinion all the time. Okay, bad. You don't want to choose on that basis. The second thing you want from the Rav is a person that you have communication dialogue with. In other words, you know, you might be of the opinion that Rav Yosef is the greatest halachic authority around today, and you might be right, but you really don't have dialogue, you don't have communication with him. You can't just, you know, text him or Facebook him and ask him your question. And therefore, it wouldn't be a great idea to choose him as a person, you know, to answer day-to-day questions. So you want to have someone who's available. It doesn't have to be face-to-face. It could be, you know, I have people calling me from Chutz Laretz or texting me questions from Chutz Laretz. It doesn't have to be face-to-face, but someone who's available. Okay? You want to have a Rav that you feel that you can communicate with, meaning not just technically, but you feel that you could express yourself fully and what the situation is. Because quite often, psak for Reuven is not the same as a psak for Shimon. The situation could often be very, very different, and it's important that they be able to express themselves and understand the need. And by the way, on the issue of Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galiyot, it is important, because you know, you can go to one rav, you can come to ask me, and for one person I might say one thing, and one person is a different situation, I might say something else, and that has to do with you can express yourself. So then let's say you decide that, I don't know, Rav Lichtenstein, okay, is the most knowledgeable person in this town, or maybe on the face of this earth, I don't know, I haven't had a contest lately, but you always find that whenever you come to talk to him, all you could say is, okay? Or if you could talk, you find that your mind is frozen and you just can't communicate. You can't, so that's not good. It wouldn't be good to use him, you know, if you can't communicate. But that, so, lastly, I would say the Rav should know you on some level. He could give a more effective guidance and decision if he knows you on some level. Okay, so about what should you do 1 day, 2 days, 1.5 days? What you have to do is ask your Rav. Simple as that. Now, let's try to get to where it all started. God once said, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, Rosh Chodeshim. Yes, Chaim. Louder, please.
What if you or your father has a minhag?
A what?
Minhag.
You have a minhag. Why not follow it?
That's what I was asking.
Yeah. I tell you, if your father said, you ask your father a lucky question, and your father, let's not say your father, one's father, and you say, I noticed for the past 10 years you, whatever it is, you know, make up a good thing. And how did you come to that conclusion? He said, well, I just went eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and I came to the decision on that basis, and ever since then it's been our minhag. Then I wouldn't follow it. But I'm saying in normal situations, of course you follow it. Why not? You know. Okay. God once said, HaKadosh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Sanhedrin, the responsibility and the authority to decide when Rosh Chodesh is. And the Rambam makes this very, very clear that what defines Rosh Chodesh is not the molad, the new moon, that sliver that all of a sudden appears out of nowhere in the sky. That's not what decides what's the first day of the Chodesh. What decides the first day of the Chodesh is the decision of Bet Din HaGadol. So if there be a stira between the Metzius of the little sliver in the sky and Bet Din HaGadol, it's Bet Din HaGadol that decides it. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. Lachem meaning that it's given to Bnei Adam, specifically to Sanhedrin, to decide. Okay? And therefore, everybody would always turn to Sanhedrin to know when Sanhedrin decided, and they would always decide when it's that little sliver. In other words, that's what they decided on that basis. And they would have Adim running to the place where they were, and it originally was by Harabayas, and later on it was different other places, whatever, running to give Adim that they saw the Mola, they saw the sliver of the moon. How would they, after they would say, okay, they would cross-examine the Adim, say, find out the telling true, and they would say, Mekudash, they would declare that day to be the first day of the month, and as a result, they would know, by the way, the suffix would always be one of two, not always, but often it's one of 2 days, because of the cycle of the moon, which is not a full, not an even 29, but it's kind of a 29 and a half days, and that's what, you know, it's always something. It's either today or tomorrow. It's either one day or the next. And they would decide. After they would decide, they had a super duper form of communication that was so incredible.
Bonfires.
Okay? Who saw the Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
No, let me rephrase that. Now I want you guys to be honest with me. Honesty to me is the most important thing. Who didn't see Lord of the Rings? Raise your
hand. Which one?
The one with the Kiddush. Okay. You people have a serious hole in your communication, in your education. A serious hole in your education. In many ways, if only to see with your own eyes the communication of the bonfires and the how it was used exactly the way it was in the time of the Mikdash. I mean, exactly. Except the people were a little taller. The people who lit it were a little bit taller. I'm assuming they're a little bit taller. But it's unbelievable. It is awe-inspiring just to see that. Just to see that one scene that would last maybe 3 minutes, it's worth watching 9 hours of that's my halakhic thing. Okay. Anyway, what they did was they set up hilltops. If you look at it, like, you see that hilltop? You notice it's an interesting coincidence that on that hilltop you see a communication tower of telephone tower. It was Ar HaYom HaZeh. We need, the height of the hill to help with the communication. But they would choose a line of the highest hilltops in the direction of Bavel, which was the largest community. Some say it would also go down to Mitzrayim, to Alexandria as well, where there was another huge community. And as soon as they declared it that day, so they would wave a fire, and the next hilltop from the Harabayim would see it, and they would already have a stack of wood ready, primed with oil, exactly like on the Lord of the Rings. And they would immediately, because it couldn't take any time, if it took each bonfire a half an hour to get things lit the way it is when we, as Boy Scouts, go out on a tule, so then it wouldn't work. So the reason why it worked was it was primed and ready to immediately go up in flames and to give that signal. And it could send the signal within 2 hours, it reached whatever it is, hundreds and hundreds of miles into Bavel, and that's how they knew, and it was a perfect system until... Until the Tzedukim, the bad guys that were very interested in usurping the authority of Beit Din HaGadol, set up their own hilltops to divert the signal, or basically to fake a signal on the wrong night, and communication broke down. Okay, and that was a period of Bitul Masa'ot, when the fires were Mavutal. It was the time of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, and basically, the only way to do it would be to go out and send shliachim. Basically, to send out messengers by foot or horseback, sometimes horseback, sometimes foot, depending on what they had. And then it took the messenger a long, long time. From that moment on, there were a great many of communities that simply did not get word in time. Now, what does it mean in time? Rosh Hashanah, there was nothing to talk about outside of Yerushalayim, it was 2 days. Okay, and then it became, after a certain point, already from the time of the mission, it became 2 days. But for Yom Kippur, it was 9 days. You could say 10 days. Meaning it was always counting from that day of Rosh Chodesh. And all the other Chagim, it was 15 days, right? So there were communities that the Shluchim simply did not reach. And since that moment, those communities that regularly the Shluchim wouldn't reach, they would basically hold 2 days, Sofek the Oraita L'chumra, holding 2 days because they're not sure if today or the next day was Yom Tov, and then that's how the Indian of Yom Tov Sheni started. Now, there were some communities that sometimes were reached and sometimes not. And when they reached, they did it. And when they weren't reached, they were machmir for 2 days. Around the second generation of Amoraim, when the Sanhedrin was sitting in a place called Tam, Sholchu Mitam, they sent out of a place called Tam, Tizharu b'minog avotechem b'yodechem. They made a gezerah, a decree, that from now on, you are locked into the minug of your forefathers when it comes to Yom Tov Sheni. And you have to always hold 2 days Yom Tov, even if the Shluchim happened to come to you on time, you are mechuyev to hold 2 days, midrabanan. Now it's a gzeir derabanan. And ever since then, again, there were certain communities that were locked in. Now, another interesting thing happened. The Sanhedrin, well, let's just say the population, the Gedolim, the leaders, things started to get worse and worse until it came to a point in the fourth generation of the Amoraim, that Hillel Hanasi HaAcharon, you know why he was called Hillel Hanasi HaAcharon? Because his mother called him Hillel, and he was the last Nasi. And he realized that he was the last Nasi, and he realized he had to do something because there wouldn't be a Beddin to be Mekadosh Lachodesh anymore. So he basically worked out a calculation what day Rosh Chodesh would fall out for the next 600 years or so, well into the future, and with his Beddin, he was Mekadosh not only that day immediately, which was always what they used to do, but he was Mekadosh it, his Chiddush was to Mekadosh it into the future based on this calculation of his Beddin. And so he froze the Jewish calendar, and that's why Ad Yom Hazeh great organizations, orphanages and yeshivot, could mail calendars in the mail in order to raise money for their causes. Okay, because it's now frozen. You can print it out, you can predict it into the future, you can even program it onto your smartphone, and you can get it figured out hundreds, even thousands of years in the future exactly what's going to be. So we know what's going to be, yet we're frozen to minhag avotechem yodechem midrabanan, you have to hold 2 days. Okay? Yes, Akiva.
So what happens when it runs out, like once we get past the time that he could
have? I don't want to think about it.
It must have been like a couple thousand years.
There's an interesting, I'm not going to be able to finish the topic, but I just want to end with this interesting story. The Brisk Rav, there's Machlokes Rishonim as to how do you measure which community is held 2 days and which held one? How do you know, which one held what? So some Rishonim say it's very simple. You draw a radius from Harabayit, a 15-day walk radius around Harabayit. Anything in the circle is 1 day. Anything outside the circle is 2 days. The other shita is Kedushat Eretz Yisrael. Anything that's considered Israel, which is more or less what's known today, anything in Kedushat Eretz Yisrael holds one. Anything outside holds two. When people used to live in Yamit, okay, like Adir's grandparents, or actually Adir's father lived in Yamit, right?
Yeah.
People used to live in Yamit. There was a whole machlokes where the Yamit and those areas had Kedusha Eretz Yisrael. The truth is, technically, there are dayot that hold that a lot doesn't have Kedusha. Who's ever been to a lot? Raise your hand. Is there any Kedusha there? Right. So there's a machlokes. Some hold that doesn't have Kedusha Eretz Yisrael, and the person that hold that in a lot, you have to hold 2 days yontif. In any case, I remember when Esti Rosenberg was something like 12 years old, she's now the Rosh Yeshiva of Migdal Oz, right? When she was 12 years old, and her, I think Ezra group was going, taking buses to do Hakafot Shniyah in Yamit to give them some support, meaning on Motzei Simchat Torah, the buses were leaving to go to drive to Yamit, her father told her that she shouldn't go because she might be chayv on 2 days Yantif if she ends up there in Yamit. That was one story. Another interesting story is that the Brisk Rav used to live on Rehov Strauss. That's right near Meir Sharim. And he held 2 days L'chumrah, or what you might call 1.5 days, even though he's Rehov Strauss. Why? Because it's a third sheet that we've shown him, that any community that it was known for a fact that the Shulchan reached held one. Any community that you don't know for a fact that the Shulchan held, you had to hold two. And he said, at the time of the Beit HaMikdash, there wasn't any population at all on the hills of Meir Sharm. It was just barren hills. So the Shulchan didn't reach it. And therefore, he was Machmir. The Rav Zatzal said, with this, Uncle went one step too far. And I'll end here. We'll continue next week.
Can you explain what the process is?
Pardon me?
Could you explain what the process is about why? Is it about, like, we're not sure about what spot, or not sure?
No. The process we've shown in the big post is whether certain